Welcome to the Pac-12 Hotline Podcast, everyone, and I am delighted to welcome AJ Maestas, the founder and CEO of Navigate, a sports agency and consultancy that is behind the scenes pushing all the buttons in college sports.
AJ, I don't know about pushing all the buttons.
I appreciate you joining me very much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
A treat for Pac-12 fans because it's a little bit of a different guest for the podcast, and in this case, different is very, very good because AJ is an expert in the matters of the media and marketing world, branding, and those are very hot topics in the Pac-12 these days, and it's going to be great for fans to hear a very different and very informed perspective on some of the topics that are causing some angst in Pac-12 world. So I appreciate it. And I should say off the top that AJ is a Pac-12 alum, as a graduate of Washington, and a Husky fan to this day.
Hi, yeah, that's right. Yeah, and by the way, a treat, I think, is a little bit of an exaggeration, but that's really kind of you to say, John. But yeah, no doubt. I went to undergrad at the University of Washington and definitely a Husky at heart, and I went to grad school at Arizona State, and I live here in Scottsdale, Arizona, so I'm actually more closely involved with Arizona State things these days.
Your favorite memory from sitting in Husky Stadium, and I assume that it was, because it almost always is, 50 degrees, wind blowing off the lake, rain coming in horizontally. Do you remember any of those days?
I've heard that it rains in Seattle. I haven't lived there in 20 years, but yeah, I've heard that before. I didn't mind it. I grew up in Alaska, so I thought Seattle had great weather as far as I was concerned. But favorite memory is tough, but I do love the Huskies. And honestly, it's the only thing I'm actually a fan of. We work with, you know, all the sports leagues, all the networks, everything you can think across sports, even globally. But there's only one thing I'm really passionate about as a fan, and that's college football. So, yeah, too many good memories to name, but I love the place and I love the game.
So quickly, if you wouldn't mind, maybe citing an example for some of our listeners in terms of what Navigate has done the last few years in the college sports world. Is there anything that you're contractually okay with disclosing?
You know, most of that work is you know, a matter of public record when you're working with public universities. So, but maybe some of the conference stuff is private. But we work with just about everything you could name on the business side, which is great. Dozens of universities on things like multimedia rights deals. We work with the broadcasters and the networks, ESPN most frequently, the distributors, most of the distributors. So we have a really fun perspective in that we get to work with people who are the buyers and the sellers and you know, where the content is going, all of these kind of things. Conference offices, obviously. I think it's okay to mention the Big 12 just because it was mentioned by the commissioner publicly a few times. And we have done work for the Pac-12 in the last year or two, but not currently doing something. So, you know, just for full disclosure, there's no doubt we have an inside look and an interesting perspective on, you know, all sides of the space. And it just happens to be a passion of mine, given that I shared with you, it's my top place for fandom. It's an area that I most enjoy working on. So no doubt we're really fortunate to be able to see collegiate athletics from all sides of the business.
The impetus for me asking AJ to join me on the podcast was that he recently participated in a roundtable discussion for a website called Athletic Director U, which does a terrific job covering college sports from the kind of administrative and management side of things. And AJ was one of three media industry experts who participated in a discussion about the Pac-12's media strategy. And it's a completely different perspective, much more informed perspective than fans and even, you know, yours truly has on the media world and how the Pac-12 has gone about creating its own model. And for the most part, the comments from AJ and the others on the roundtable were very positive about what the Pac-12 is trying to do. Obviously, nobody knows exactly what's going to happen 5-6 years from now, but there's a lot of reason for fans to be cautiously optimistic, maybe that's the right phrase, about what Larry Scott is doing. So, AJ, I was wondering if you could kind of walk us through your view I've got some specific stuff to ask you about, but could you walk us through your general view of the Pac-12's approach with 100% ownership in the Pac-12 networks?
Well, sure, and you know, a little bit of this was covered in that publication, ADU, and the gist of it is, you know, they kept 100% ownership. That's unique in this specific circumstance. I think something that might be helpful, you know, as a fan, you know, who's watching the comings and goings of, you know, collegiate athletics and wondering where the Pac-12 stands versus others, is to understand that charter. And I don't have it in front of me right now, but the charter, you know, from the ultimate decision makers, which are the presidents of these universities, it had revenue, I think, maybe sixth on the list. There were things like distributing great content locally for those universities, giving them a platform for not just athletics, but academics, you know, a real emphasis on all sports, you know, Olympic athletes, so forth and so on, or Olympic sports, as they call it. So if you were to read that charter of what they were trying to accomplish with the network and understand the circumstances in that moment where they did a blockbuster tier one deal with Fox and ESPN, so much beyond their needs and maybe even goals, that it afforded them the luxury of not putting revenue as the top objective and allowed them to serve other missions and other intentions with what they did with the network. Again, if you put that all into context and then could see that charter and what their priorities were, well, they just nailed that charter. Now, that might not perfectly satisfy every fan, and you may have issues with a number of things about it, and I think there's things they do differently, admittedly. But if you could turn back the clock in that moment and that decision at that time, it was brave and it was innovative and it was different, but it perfectly served the mission of what the conference and the universities were trying to achieve. And it really was a great success. You know, the obvious places that are most commonly talked about, well, where it fell short, those were risks that were, you know, accepted in making those trade-off choices.
My view has always been that on the tier one side, Larry Scott got certainly the best deal he could have hoped to get. Part of that was his own doing and the way he worked the system and the negotiating table. Part of it, I think, was a little bit of good fortune, just where the media rights were going at the time. The fact that Comcast jumped into the negotiations, which helped drive the price up for Fox and ESPN. The networks itself, I can see why they would want 100% ownership over the long haul, or a Big Ten model, for instance. What I get stuck on is the six regional feeds, and did they overshoot their audience? Is there too much content and thus too much expense? Could they be more efficient? And if they were more efficient with what they're distributing, would they be more efficient on the bottom line and maybe have better distribution? Do you have any thoughts in particular about the way they structured the Pac-12 networks?
Well, I do, and it's always easy in hindsight, right? We get these once-a-decade chance to strike these deals or create things like a network or make these investments, sometimes once-ever opportunities. But I don't disagree with your take on that. If the charter was different and the objective was different and you were doing it today, would you create six feeds? There's things that created challenges for. There was a time when bandwidth was limited by distributors, you know, and they could only put on so many channels or only had room for so many channels. This is even still true to a certain extent. And so that could create a challenge in getting distribution and giving people that you know, set of channels and giving them that much real estate, essentially, right, inside their portfolio of channels. But again, you know, they were serving that mission at that time. But big picture, in trying to think about, you know, what your average listener and reader would want to know, there's things to do different, but it isn't a disaster. By owning and retaining 100% of the equity, they have something of value, of significant value, and more important than even of the value that's been created over the last 6 years, you know, just out of thin air by taking those rights themselves, there's a great deal of real options available to the conference. And I think this does get mentioned a decent amount, but possibly not enough in the press, whereas, you know, other conferences have given away these rights or have for a long amount of time and don't have that control as a negotiating chip or that flexibility. the Pac-12 does. So whether it be tomorrow or it be in 6 years with the next, you know, tier one deal, there are a lot of options available to them for a changing landscape as far as new technology players, new distributors, new producers of media. And there's no doubt that the media world is rapidly changing. So having this flexibility and optionality is it's actually a really good time. If you don't view 6 years as a lot of time, you know, it is a really good time. And it'll be even more clear of a landscape in 6 years. So I can understand why some people call it a failure and why they're disappointed with the revenue on a per school or overall basis that it's distributing, or how they're bothered by the costs, because, you know, that many channels, the quality of production, which I think is excellent, you know, the app, a lot of these things that I think are great, you know, they come at a cost. Creating and running your own studios and all that real estate, that comes at a great cost. So I could see the causes and concerns and why it might be done differently if it could be done again. But the truth is at a really high level, at that 30,000 foot level, would I want to be holding the chips they're holding on a relative basis? I would. I still like these moves, and I think they'll still prove out to be smart in the long run.
So I interviewed Colorado President Phil DeStefano in, I think it was August. And he's taking over as head of the CEO board. He's the boss of the bosses, so to speak, the presidents and chancellors. And he told me that he thought everything should be on the table to discuss, including a potential equity sale of the Pac-12 networks before the current contract runs up. And we should remind everybody, current Tier 1 deal with Fox and ESPN and the major Pac-12 networks deals all expire basically in the summer of 2024. Pac-12 will have the rights to all of its content. Football, men's basketball, Olympic sports will all be on the table in 2024. Chancellor DeStefano said we should explore all options as to whether maybe selling ahead of time is the best move. When you look at the landscape, AJ, do you see a reasonable path or a reasonable option for selling early? Obviously, if you're going to sell, you got to have a buyer. Or do you think that at this point, it's most likely that the conference will just retain all of its rights until that negotiating window opens?
I'll answer that in reverse order. You know, I think they will hold on to it.
It was a long question.
No, it's okay. I just that's the way my mind works, I guess. I would hold on to those rights until that time. And my reason for that is that this changing media landscape, it's not clear yet who the ultimate player is going to be. And this bleeds into the second, your first question and my second answer, which is that I wouldn't sell that equity. But I think the option should always be on the table. And it is, because they own 100% of it. So they and they alone can choose whenever they want to sell a piece of that equity. Now, I think I mentioned this before in that at least article that you covered. I cannot think of a sports property, a team, you know, a league or what have you, that has ever regretted retaining equity in media. In some cases, things like the YES Network with the Yankees and some of these regional sports networks, it's proven to be as valuable as the team itself. I think the YES Network sold for a couple billion, and despite making an unbelievable profit off the creation of the YES Network, the Yankees are trying to buy it back now. So it's just one example of the value of these rights and control of that media and content and everything it does, from advertising and sponsorship to distribution, in this direct-to-consumer world that we're living in now, and the value that has over time versus alternative investments. It has grown at double or triple the rate of inflation over the last 20 years, and most people bet that you can do that again. So to answer that original question again and sort of say, you know, would you sell that equity? I wouldn't. Selling equity is permanent. That's in perpetuity. But I like it that they have the option. In the next 6 years, we'll see how this media landscape shakes out. And what used to be a dominant player in ABC, ESPN, or Fox, you know, who's to say that company in 6 years isn't named Google or Microsoft or Amazon or any number of other new tech media players, right, that are getting into the streaming space and going direct to consumer. In that scenario, if I believed I was aligning with a 40, 50, 60-year winner, you know, if I was aligning with ESPN in 1980 and I had that vision to tell it was 1980 and we're going to have an amazing 40-year run, would I be willing to sell some of the equity to create an incentive for them to treat me right and to align our incentives and to know I had that partner long term? Yeah, maybe. But again, it's in perpetuity. and it's realistic that there's some form of multimedia distribution following Pac-12 sports from now until the end of our planet. So I'd hold on to it. I think that by any conservative calculation of what it might be worth in the open market, it's worth plenty more than enough to bridge the gap of what they might have sacrificed in revenue from the network over the strategy so far. And I think that will continue to be true.
Right. That to me will be the big key is, are whatever they do, is it going to not only be a great deal for the future, but offset, kind of having to bite the bullet a little bit here during these 12 years. Is there I'm sure you don't have your list of expiring media deals right in front of you here, so I apologize. But is there anything that you're going to look for? Is it like a signpost up ahead that you think is going to help set the market or determine the course for the Pac-12 when they do negotiate? I know the Big Ten is up, I think, 1 year before the Pac-12 is. And I want to say the NFL, maybe Monday Night Football or maybe the whole NFL package is up as well. What if you're a Pac-12 fan and you're kind of looking out to see what should I be paying attention to?
Well, we get to see evidence every day. I mean, there's an MLB deal recently. There's the NBA deal a couple of years ago, outstanding high water marks on a per ratings basis, on a per audience basis, et cetera. So there's some really good signs. If you're watching right now, there's evidence where you could say, despite some of the challenges with cord cutting and a more fragmented landscape in the media world, that there's plenty of competition for quality content. And just as a general rule of thumb, more bidders usually means a higher price, right? If you're selling something. So for now, it as tough as it's been on some who don't have premium and quality content, it hasn't hurt the property, you know, like something like the Pac-12 side yet. So I would be watching these in addition to, I'm supposed to know these things off the top of my head, but I can't remember them all perfectly. But every major collegiate conference happens, I think, between 2021 and 2026 when the Pac-12 happens, and as does almost every major contract with the big sports leagues, the NFL, MLB, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there will be an incredible amount of pieces of evidence that we can look at to what people value and what it's worth. And I would expect that story to tell a promising, positive, encouraging story to someone who owns and controls rights and the value of selling those rights. If I could dip back for a second, John.
Dip all you want. Something.
Okay. Well, you mentioned something, and I think it's important because I know there's a lot of complaints about the Pac-12 Network and how much money it distributes to the member universities. People constantly are citing the SEC and the Big Ten in particular and looking at their network success and saying we don't have that much money. I just can't help resist saying the amount of money the Pac-12 has sacrificed with their strategy in net revenue distributed to member institutions wouldn't draw it even with the SEC and the Big Ten.
Correct.
Look at any metric from ratings to attendance to fan affinity, population, corporate headquarters, et cetera, whatever metric you want to look at. The natural order of things is that the Pac-12 should not be earning the kind of revenue of the SEC or Big Ten universities. And if you look at it through that lens, you'd realize the amount the Pac-12 network is, in theory, hypothetically, sacrificing on an annual basis based on their priorities and their choice and strategy wouldn't be that much. And so that hurdle isn't that high to clear based on things like the value of the equity they've retained and the optionality that we keep referring to. So I'm sorry to belabor the point, but I feel like it gets missed in the public dialogue quite a bit.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely a very, very good point to make. Is there a metric by which you can generally say SEC rights are worth, you know, X percent more than the Pac-12, Big Ten, X percent more, just based on what you know of fan affinity and TV numbers? And
you know, I should have that off the top of my head, and I don't. But just doing some really rough math, don't hold me to this, but you look at some of the real drivers And the drivers, by the way, of this media value are eyeballs and audience. That's for advertising and free-to-air, networks. And then in the pay TV world, it's about the subscriber fee, what you pay per month to have that channel, whether it be direct-to-consumer via an over-the-top platform or, what part that comprises of your total cable or satellite bill that you pay, and will you switch if you don't get that content, right? So an Correct. Example of that would be, I know it causes a lot of people pain that the Pac-12 networks is not on DirecTV, but I can assure you it would be on DirecTV if millions and millions of Pac-12 fans switched to Dish or a normal cable carrier when they didn't take the content and they didn't distribute it. If you voted with your wallet, essentially, you'd be held to that. So the key metric there is understanding switching costs in what I pay for to see television and the content I want to see as a part of a cable bill or a la carte on something like, Sling or what have you, and total audience eyeballs. And so you look at those metrics, and I think just a rough guess off the top of my head saying something like 40%, higher audiences and likelihood of switching. I might be even conservative in saying that. So there's other factors, right? People have to fill up their schedule and their calendar. So maybe it's not your highest priority content, but if you choose college football or basketball as something you're going to do because sports is your business and your name is ESPN, you have to fill out a schedule, fill out a day, fill out a week, et cetera, et cetera. But general rule of thumb, if the eyeballs are there and there's a wallet behind that, that votes, then it's going to get more money.
Yeah, good point. And we should say, to be fair, the difference between what the Pac-12 is generating in media and conference revenue compared to SEC and Big Ten schools, the disparity is much smaller than it was in the, first decade of the century when the Big Ten schools were bringing home more than double in some years total conference distribution compared to Pac-10 schools. So that's another important point, that the conference has made up some of the difference. It had made up more early in this media deal cycle, and now as the Big Ten and SEC have redone their deals, the gap has expanded a little, but it's still a much better position than it was, 15 years ago, for instance.
Absolutely. Go ahead. Sorry to cut you off.
No, go.
The history is relevant, and also the timing of these deals can kind of skew that perception. There was a time when the Pac-12 was earning more than those conferences because their deal had been reset to new current market conditions. But if you normalize for what the value of the conference really is and what they get, and then over time, I'm really appreciating you noting that fact. The Pac-12 roughly quadrupled their deal last time, their tier one deal. And then you look at sort of the natural order of this and where that fan affinity, that voting with your wallet on what you'll pay to see on TV and what you tune in to see for free. I think it actually shines a very favorable light on the Pac-12. A far better comparison would be the ACC and the Big 12. And it doesn't seem like many of these articles compare the Pac-12 network to the non-existent network of the Big 12 or the nascent network, it appears only digital for now, right? Some linear, but I think it's a digital thing at the ACC. And they made a very long-term commitment on their tier one rights to secure, the opportunity for that network. Far better comparison is to ask yourself, what does the ACC and the Big 12 have versus the Pac-12? And I think there's a similar exercise you could go through on tier one rights I don't mean to belabor the point, but I think that's a far better comparison to ask ourselves, and that makes the Pac-12 look awfully favorable, right?
Well, it does, yeah. I mean, certainly the Big 12 schools, if the media reports are reasonably accurate, and the conferences are disclosing apples to apples, the Big 12 is certainly bringing in more or distributing more per campus per year, but they also don't own their own media network. So there's that trade-off.
Right. And that can be really lucrative for Texas, as an example, I think it's publicly reported at $15 million per year. In a third tier deal for their personal network, but you can guess that number is much smaller and it isn't much of a contributor at all to the bottom line at some of the other campuses. And so, you know, a fair comparison would be asking, and by the way, it's more than just revenue. There's about recruiting and spreading your brand and all the other missions, you know, that a network can serve for you. Because in that example with the Big 12, I think they might have one football game, maybe two football games per year that are on it. So anyway, it's just something that hasn't been done yet. And if I'm a fan and I'm asking my, if I wanted to ask myself the fair question, I'd say, based on the affinity and passion and value of what the Pac-12 is worth, am I being served? Am I getting a media product, you know, that I deserve? Is it worthy? And if you compare versus ACC and Big 12, I feel like you'd have a lot more satisfied fan base.
Yeah, that's probably true. I think part of the reason the Big Ten's always compared is because the two conferences have such a history together, right? With the Rose Bowl and the Pac-12 has always viewed itself, the Big Ten is like its, you know, its closest peer in terms of pursuing an academic mission that's in line with the values of the universities. So it's kind of a more natural comparison, because I think that's what the Pac-12 presidents and CEOs, when you ask them, well, what's your closest, your cousin in the conference world, they would probably say the Big Ten. So that kind of ends up winding you down the path where you compare the two, even though certainly fan affinity and those other things are very different.
Oh, no, I get that. And just for fun, since I think we're talking too much business and I can't imagine being a fan and wanting to listen this far.
Oh, some hotline fans love this stuff.
Well, good. I guess we have educated fans in the Pac-12. That we can be very
definitely
grateful for. Well, a fun exercise would be go to Beaver Stadium, go to the Big House, go to the Horseshoe, go to Nebraska Memorial Stadium and take a look at 100,000 plus people in a packed place that's perpetually sold out. And I think it would be a healthy experience if you get a chance to go to an away game at one of those places and see the atmosphere. It's a lesson. Those places are filling up with twice as many as, you know, the average Pac-12 university. And I'm not trying to knock the marketing efforts of what the Pac-12 is doing. I think that's more of a socioeconomic reality of the West Coast versus the Midwest.
So let me ask you about a recent development, AJ, which is that the Oregonian reported the Pac-12 is looking for an investor. According to the document, $500 million would get you 10% ownership of what sounds like an umbrella company that's going to own all the media rights. Do you have any thoughts on this one? It's a little bit out of nowhere. It seems very creative, for sure.
Well, yeah, it's creative. And again, I think it is innovative. I think everything should be on the table, right? And if you look around the professional sports world, it is not rare or strange at all to bring in private equity money or to bring in other investors. There's even a league that has done this. Major League Soccer has an entity called SUM, Soccer United Marketing, which very wisely and very intelligently took private equity money and went out and acquired rights. So they have more to distribute than just Major League Soccer games. They have tournaments and other soccer-related things. They turned into sort of like a media company. And I think it was a very smart strategy. And I think it's something that is a real win for the league and for those investors as well. It's definitely not traditional in the collegiate world, but this is, very smart to consider. But if I could just back up for a second and even just talk about the article and those documents, I feel sick for the folks over there at the Pac-12. We've had the good fortune of being in these rooms many of the time. And your strategic planning, you're considering options. I mean, this is not meant for public consumption. And I think that immediately the dialogue around this made a few leaps that may not be true on what the real intentions are, or what the real structure would be, or even just saying they're selling equity in the conference. I'd be shocked if they sold equity in the conference, right? That's almost buying a piece of the universities and so forth and so on. So creating a media entity, you know, so forth and so on, is there term limits on that? You know, some of these things are not clear based on those documents, but again, backing up, I this is not helpful to have this be public information. And it's unlikely that it's the true story or full outcome, or that we know everything now, including myself, right? There's things we don't know just because this one document leaked.
It sounds to me, if I'm
if I've got the right handle on it, it's almost like a bridge loan. They are looking for some revenue to bridge the gap between now and 2024 when they get a new media deal, but they're doing it in a way where they wouldn't have to necessarily sell 51% of the Pac-12 networks, because they're creating this holding company and then looking for a partner in that holding company. So Larry Scott can still take all of his inventory, all of his content to the marketplace in 2024 to see what he can get from that. Do you think that's the right read on what they're thinking?
You know, I don't really know, but it sure looks that way. It certainly appears that way. And if you were to look at the pressure that they must be feeling, and again, we've already discussed this today, but what is that gap and what should the gap really be? The gap is not that bad. And if you really compare the Pac-12 to the ACC and Big 12, not only is it not that bad, and we're talking about the Pac-12 network here, and overall, is it really a problem? I actually disagree with that. They are passing on some money with the decisions they've made, but that was strategic and that was the intention. But with that said, that's sure what it looks like. It sure looks like the pressure, you know, from campuses and then just in general public perception, you know, saying, you know, you're behind, is saying, okay, well, what you don't know is we created this incredible value of what we've done here with our network, and we can extrapolate that value at any time in the open market by selling some of it or even over a term length or something, and proving that they can. So let's see if they actually do. But I would be very confident that if they so chose to go forward with the kind of plan that was outlined, and that they'd have plenty of interested buyers.
So when Larry Scott sits down at the negotiating table in, you know, fall of 2022, spring of 2023, and he's got all of his content available to the highest bidder, what is going to drive that value? How will ESPN or Fox or Amazon or Google, how will they value that content? To me, it's the premium football games and then everything else, right? And I don't know how much everything else is going to be worth, but I certainly know that Fox and ESPN set the market, you know, right now for those, whatever they have, 44 football games. That seems like it's going to be the prime driver. Is that a correct assumption?
Well, yeah, the premium inventory is critical. It's football. And one of the cool things about this situation is that we don't have to assume that the Pac-12's next deal has to be a tier one deal where a big national network like an ABC, ESPN, or a Fox get the best games, and then the network gets the next best. We don't have to have any of these assumptions. Just because history has tended to follow suit where there's a tier one deal that comes up on a different schedule for bid, and then, you know, a network bids and buys it, and then there's a tier two deal, et cetera, et cetera. They could rewrite the script and mix and match in any way they want. And the reason I think that's so meaningful is my comment earlier about who is the future of television. What if Amazon and Google are buy some networks and sitting on the mountain of money that they sit on? I've heard it before that Apple and Google could each buy every pro sports team in the country, you know, in cash, just in their cash reserves. I don't even know if that's true, but the point is they could buy
good.
A major yeah, it sounds good. Yeah, it sounds fun. Not that they're for sale. But you can see that these companies could buy a network and just make that a division of theirs to make them smarter about the television business, right? And video and media. So is there an assumption that's how it's going to look? And is that the important content? Sure, it is. But I'm trying to share stuff that I think I would find interesting if I were a fan. Who knows how it's going to look at that time? And there's one conference that has all of the optionality, all of that creativity available to itself. It happens to be on the West Coast where they're all headquartered, and those businesses tend to be owned and run by alumni of these Pac-12 universities, right? So who's to say where it's going to go? But yeah, the premier stuff is what is valued. but there's changing things about this landscape. So as an example, historically, free-to-air television, you know, your major networks, it was all about advertising revenue is how they justified what they could pay for content, like football games. And then along came pay TV and ESPN, where they had a second revenue stream, which was subscriptions, which is roughly, you know, 2/3, 75%, you know, whatever, depending on what pay TV sports network it is, of their revenue actually comes from the sub fees, comes from your cable bill. And so as leagues were more comfortable letting ESPN broadcast their sports, no one could compete with ESPN in rights fees. You know, they paid almost double with the last NFL deal than the free-to-air networks did for Monday Night Football. But it's because their business model was that much more lucrative. The only thing holding them back from having everything was that historically their distribution was less than free-to-air TV, and leagues were worried about it not reaching enough fans. And so pay TV was sort of, you know, for only specialty content or a few games, but not the big ones like the Super Bowl or Monday Night Football, which has obviously changed. So there's another version of that. I mean, what Amazon is doing is, I mean, at the end of the day, with their Prime subscription, they want to sell you stuff too as a retailer. There's almost a third revenue stream, right, that exists if you're Amazon, in your relationship with a customer, having a direct-to-consumer relationship as a subscriber or payer, and that's shipping stuff to your house and putting you on Prime. So anyway, I'm sharing this all to say that this is 2018. We've got very little of this was clear or known 6 years ago. No one was talking about over the top and direct to consumer, and Amazon was you know not in generally in the television business. So what could be possible in 6 years? Who knows? A lot could be possible. But to come back to your question, is that tier one content important and is that super valuable? There's no doubt it is. But the Pac-12 has all these tools they can play with, like, you know, creating an equity partner in them or creating a direct network, and they're learning about direct to consumer and selling direct, you know, having that relationship with that many of the traditional networks don't know. You know, their customer was the four major, you know, distributors, and that's how they sold their product. And now you have to get into the business of selling to every single household, really, every doorstep. So I'm sorry to go on so long about that, but I think it's relevant to say, yeah, the tier one stuff matters in this next deal. But there are many unknowns and many things that are changing between now and 2024.
So I got two more for you here, and you know, feel free to ramble as you see fit here. This is fascinating stuff. I mean, I'm learning something here. I hopefully our listeners are. So first question: what should we make of the fact that Major League Baseball just signed with Fox for, is it 7 or 8 more years? To me, that indicated MLB is making a bet on, you know, kind of the legacy media traditional distribution. And if they're doing it, wouldn't that indicate that it's probably the smart move for the Big Ten and the Pac-12 when their rights come up?
Ooh, well, again, 6 years could be, at the speed things are changing, a very different landscape. But I don't think these legacy players are going away that quickly. For those that don't know, Fox is selling, and Disney ABC is a buyer. There's a lot of things that are changing about what's going to be a part of Fox as you know it today versus what is a part of Fox in the future. But as it appears, Fox Network, you know, national network, will be, you know, its own entity. And if you look at that and say, what is their core business and what are they going to do? I'd be shocked if there weren't two things that are extremely important to them in the future. And those two things, and this is just an opinion, but those two things would be live sports. So it doesn't surprise me at all that they paid the kind of money to get MLB to commit long term and to be in that relationship. And gambling, you know, as gambling becomes legalized, it, you know, Fox's founder is Australian at the grand final, which is their name of the Super Bowl for their two rugby leagues, AFL and NRL, in the concourse during their grand final, you can make bets, you know, from a terminal. I mean, there's terminals and bars that are almost like a Bloomberg trading desk terminal where you look at the ticker with all the bets and everything that's taking place. And it's an integral part of the culture. It is a compounding positive effect on viewership and fandom and cross team viewing and things like that, you know, why you might be interested in someone other than your hometown team. And so it's in Fox's DNA, gambling, back to their headquarters. They're essentially ESPN in Australia. They have Fox 1, 2, 3, you know, you get the gist of it. So
I do. Fox, I'm living in the wrong country, apparently.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun. Yeah, you want to have a good time, go drink a beer with an Australian, place a bet, go watch some Aussie rules football. It's pretty cool stuff. But the point of all that is to say, you know, where's Fox? I'd be shocked if Fox doesn't go big on live sports and you don't see them taking bets as a network. I know that sounds crazy and weird, but that's what I would predict. And that would put them as close as they could be to live sports in the future. So I don't think it's crazy that they're an aggressive bidder for quality sport content over all those professional and collegiate league deals that are coming up that we talked about over the next 7 years.
Last question, and this is fairly specific to two teams in the Pac-12 in particular. It is my contention that how well the Pac-12 does for its next round of media rights depends not entirely and maybe not even halfway, but certainly to an extent on USC and UCLA. The Trojans maybe even more than the Bruins just because of the football brand. But I got to think that if those two programs are having good years in, say, 2021, 2022, that is going to maybe change the dynamic a little bit for Larry Scott in the conference. Is that putting too much emphasis on those two programs?
I don't think that's a crazy thing to say at all. And you're generalizing, but I'm generalizing too to make this, you know, palatable for someone who's a fan who wants to know a little bit more about, you know, the business behind it. And so sticking with those generalizations, as a rule of thumb, you could kind of say, you know, football is worth 80% of why someone would buy rights to a conference, and basketball is 20%, and everything else is just a nice to have. Again, I'm generalizing, but if you use that as a ratio, you'd say football is the end all be all. And you could almost even drop UCLA from your comment. Now, I think that's different when you know, being a fan of the Pac-12 and understanding the nuances of that media market and Chip Kelly's success at Oregon, you have to assume that he can have equal or greater success at recruiting out of Los Angeles and playing in the Rose Bowl. So maybe UCLA becomes a football power and matters in a pretty big way. But USC, if I were to really narrow it down, I'd say USC's football success. No question. It's the number two media market in the country, and the number one media market, New York City, isn't college football crazy and is highly splintered and fragmented among other sports and other college teams and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, LA is, if there was one amazing thing the Pac-12 had, it would be Los Angeles. And you could say that for recruiting. You could say that for the media marketplace. It's even really highly skewed towards satellite, which is the reason that's valuable. And by satellite, I mean DirecTV and Dish. The reason that's valuable is because you can do a deal with those, and anybody can get satellite, right? In the United States, you're not limited to whatever cable company serves your specific area or your neighborhood or your city. So, yeah, LA is an extremely valuable thing. And to generalize, if USC was great at football come the next negotiation and getting great ratings, that would be a good thing for everybody.
I mean, I think back to what happened in the run-up to the negotiations in 2011. USC was still kind of in their afterglow of the Carroll era. Oregon played for the national title with Chip Kelly, and Stanford was on the ascent there with Harbaugh and Luck in the Orange Bowl, and the football product had three marquee programs, at least in terms of, you know, capturing the national attention. And it seemed like that was a high watermark and may have had an impact on how the networks valued Pac-12 football. So that's kind of why I was thinking they need to maybe recreate that situation here in the next few years with USC at the center of it in order to kind of maximize what they can get.
Yeah, I'm glad you actually brought that up with Oregon, because as much as it pains me to say, Oregon was a great yeah, as a Husky fan and a Sun Devil season ticket holder, they were a great TV product at that time. They still are. So you can defy your media market, and there's a ton of examples around the country, but There are, you know, fans that I'm guessing couldn't point to Oregon on a map that would tune in to watch Oregon, you know, sex appeal with the uniforms and just great job they did with their brand. So believe it or not, Oregon, with an unbelievably small population, you know, small corporate base, you know, there's not a lot of D1 talent there, et cetera, had built itself into something nationally appealing from a ratings basis. And so it they carried great weight. So it doesn't have to be an LA-based school, but USC's history and what have you, you know, it's pretty obvious that USC would be the one that you would point out and say that would be a critical chip in the negotiation and something that you'd want to see valuable. Hopefully Washington is that in the future. Seattle isn't exactly a market you turn your nose up at. And I'm beyond just being a biased, you know, alumnus and fan. I think Chris Peterson's exceptional by any objective measure. And it's not unrealistic that UCLA gets great under Chip Kelly and Washington stays great under Chris Peterson and USC rebounds, because it's hard for them not to be great with their, you know, history and recruiting and what have you. And 6 years from now, there's no reason, I don't think, to see anything other than a really strong Pac-12 that's really valuable during the next TV deal. And then all these business things that we just spent the last 45 minutes discussing, well, those put the conference in a really nice position as well. So if on a relative basis, and I think we've discussed those relatives against the SEC and Big Ten versus things like the Big 12 and ACC, being realistic about the relative position of the Pac-12, I love where they're at for the future, and I love the position they're in.
Can't thank you enough.
Yeah, well, hopefully it was enjoyable. Hopefully it was helpful, and I'm grateful that you even thought of me to share some insight. So
absolutely.
Don't worry, Pac-12 fans. The future's bright, and there's a natural ebb and flow, and we didn't even get into on-field competitiveness and recruiting and some of these key indicators, but I personally think it's just a streak of bad luck here with basketball and football, and just, you know, wait a year or two and it could be the opposite story. So yep. I'm not concerned. I'm optimistic.
Can't tell you how much I appreciate you joining me here.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks, John.
Thank you.